Our returns for last fiscal year were 11.8%, and we're very proud of that.
The state announces this year's PFD amount. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, the 21st of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, the FDA delays a decision on genetically modified salmon.
This committee that many of us figured was just going to rubber stamp this new genetically engineered salmon said to the FDA, no, this is not good enough.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by Grant Station, your fast track to funding, helping identify appropriate grant makers for your organization's programs and projects. On the web at grantstation.com.
So Alaskans, your dividend this year will be $1,281.
That's Governor Sean Parnell announcing this year's permanent fund dividend. Parnell and other administration members announced the amount in the lobby of the Juneau building that houses the main offices of the Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation. This year's amount is only slightly less than last year's dividend of $1,305. That's even with what Alaska Permanent Fund Corporation Executive Director Mike Burns says was one of the five all-time worst years in the stock market ever.
2008 was clearly an unusual year. Our returns for last fiscal year were 11.8%, and we're very proud of that. The formula for the dividend is based on the five-year average of statutory net income, which is part of our accounting that can be, I think, sometimes very confusing to people.
Despite that recent volatility, the total value of the Alaska Permanent Fund is now at $35.6 billion. A total of $821.9 million is being paid out this year to 641,595 Alaskans. Approximately 30,000 other applications are still under review. Dividends will be directly deposited into bank accounts on October 7th. That's also the day when paper checks will go in the regular mail. Senate Republicans will likely strip Senator Murkowski of her ranking position on the Energy Committee as punishment for her decision to run a write-in campaign. Murkowski lost the GOP primary last month, but says she's still a Republican. That's not enough for party members in the Senate who are backing primary winner Joe Miller. Tomorrow afternoon, Republican senators will meet behind closed doors to vote on whether to take away Murkowski's powerful position as their top member on the Energy Committee. It's been a plum seat, especially for an Alaskan legislator, weighing in on oil and gas issues and renewable energy legislation. The other nine Republican members are expected to recommend the move. Murkowski would still sit on the committee, just not as one of its leaders. She already resigned from her leadership role as vice chair of the Senate Republican Conference after pressure from GOP Senate leader Mitch McConnell. McConnell told reporters today that Republicans will choose tomorrow who will replace her in the top inner circle of Republican leaders.
There is also an issue as to whether or not it's appropriate for her under the circumstances. Can you, as ranking member on the Energy Committee, both of those issues will be addressed tomorrow afternoon, and they're under consideration now.
Lisa Murkowski is not in Washington this week, so she won't be at tomorrow's meeting. She decided to stay in Alaska to campaign, which is not unusual for embattled candidates. She was the only member of the Senate who missed today's vote on whether to bring to the floor the defense authorization bill, which included the controversial Don't Ask, Don't Tell. Murkowski's vote was not seen as crucial or a swing vote because all Republicans voted no. Senate Democrats lost their attempt today to take up the major military bill that includes allowing the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the Clinton-era policy banning openly gay soldiers in the military. The defense authorization bill also called for $726 billion in defense spending, including a pay raise for troops. Democrats weren't able to gain any Republicans. Alaska Democratic Senator Mark Begich says it's too bad the vote to start debate on the bill faltered because he believes it's time to discuss allowing gays to serve openly in the military.
We had this debate in Armed Services Committee. It's added to the bill. We now, in Iraq and in Afghanistan, we fight with almost a dozen different countries that have no discrimination policy like this. And the generals that we've heard from say, let's move forward. This gives a process to move forward, and I think that's a rational way to do it, and I think it's the right approach.
Supporters like Senator Begich point out that the Senate bill would not immediately lift Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It would wait until a study is completed and the president and top military commanders agree that ending the law would not hurt troop morale or battle readiness. Defense Secretary Robert Gates and Joint Chiefs of Staff Chairman Admiral Mike Mullen have called to end the ban on openly gay service members. But today, the president's appointee to head the Marine Corps, General James Amos, told the Senate Armed Services Committee that he fears changing the policy will be distracting to Marines in the battlefield. It may be some time before the Federal Food and Drug Administration decides whether or not to allow genetically engineered Atlantic salmon to reach local food markets. After 3 days of meetings on the issue in Maryland, the jury is still out. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
The FDA's Veterinary Medicine Advisory Committee met to address science-based issues associated with the application by Aqua Bounty Technologies for FDA approval for human consumption of the company's genetically engineered salmon. The Sunday and Monday science-related meetings were open to the public, although Tuesday's public comments were restricted to the issue of labeling. Winona Hauter is executive director of Food and Water Watch, a Washington, D.C.-based organization which opposes genetically engineered, or GE, animals.
Well, I think the FDA has now stated publicly that there should be more studies. I think that they were put in a very awkward position. They are embarrassed by the very poor science that was used.
Hauter attended the science meetings, commenting on the fact that the FDA's assessment of the food safety of the salmon was based on limited research.
There were four studies, three of which were non-peer-reviewed, submitted by the company, and that was almost the entire basis of the analysis. And then there was a study that was from a peer-reviewed journal, but it was 18 years old.
Hauter says there was little information about the allergenic potency of the salmon or its long-term impacts, remarking that certain procedural errors in Aqua Bounty's studies raised red flags. Aqua Bounty's Aqua Advantage genetically engineered Atlantic salmon grow faster and larger than do wild fish. The GE fish have been modified with a Chinook salmon growth gene. J.D. Hansen, a senior policy analyst for the Center for Food Safety in Washington, D.C., also attended the meetings and says the Veterinary Medicine Advisory Committee found the research on the GE salmon to be deficient.
This committee that many of us figured was just going to rubber stamp this new genetically engineered salmon said to the FDA, no, this is not good enough. The company has got to provide us better data before we can even think about approving this.
Hansen says the FDA's hearing on labeling today was not particularly productive, although attendance was evenly split between biotechnology employees and the general public.
The other industry people were saying, no, we don't want this labeled. It would set a bad precedent for other GE animals. We would like it labeled. We believe that it's a different fish than what people can find in the market.
Hauter says the fish should at least be labeled GE salmon or genetically engineered salmon, and long-term feeding studies should be conducted to ensure that there are no allergic reactions associated with eating the fish. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tallying the data on an unusually warm fall.
A grand high to record every day between Sunday and Friday, and record highs on Sunday at both Nome and Kotzebue.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. If you know an Alaskan struggling to find health insurance because of a pre-existing medical condition, encourage them to talk to a local insurance broker about the new temporary federal insurance program being administered by ACHEA, the Alaska Comprehensive Health Insurance Association. The program is for those with qualifying pre-existing conditions and who have been uninsured for at least 6 months. Talk to an independent insurance broker or go online to ACHIA.com. This message sponsored by ACHEA Fed.
state contractors working to repair rain-damaged sections of the Taylor Highway between Chicken and Eagle for 2 months are making progress. Department of Transportation spokeswoman Meadow Bailey says work on slides and washouts on the 30 miles between Chicken and Top of the World Highway Junction is nearing completion.
So people can travel up until the junction of the Top of the World Highway and through Chicken without any assistance for the most part, not waiting for convoys. There are some sections in there where occasionally there'll be flaggers or there might be a pilot car to lead people through, but the delays are fairly minimal and the road is in pretty good condition down there and we're almost completed with those repairs.
Bailey says the state plans to work into the winter to get the next 60 miles to Eagle fixed. That stretch has been closed except for a few vehicle convoys earlier this month. Bailey says the state will provide additional opportunities to drive in and out of the Yukon River community beginning September 26th.
There's a set of about four different convoys starting September 26th and then running through on different days until October 17th.
The convoys are scheduled to allow Eagle residents a chance to make road trips to Fairbanks and Anchorage. Ann Millard of Eagle says locals have a lot to do in town, including getting supplies for winter.
All kinds of stuff from dog food to people food to supplies, any kind of building materials or anything that they haven't been able to get all summer. But I think the biggest issue has been doctor's appointments because people have rescheduled and at least three times already.
Millard says fuel will also be trucked into Eagle during the convoys. The Taylor Highway is not maintained in the winter, and the road is usually closed by ice and snow around mid-October. The DOT's Bailey says the agency is seeking funding for snow removal to allow travel at least through October. Last year, a team that included scientists, business owners, environmentalists, and native leaders in Alaska released a report outlining action the state can take to begin adapting to climate change. What has the state government done with the report since then? Nothing, according to Terry Chapin, a University of Alaska Fairbanks ecology professor. Today, Chapin summarized those recommendations during a live internet presentation for the Alaska Center for Climate Assessment and Policy. One idea he is particularly excited about is a knowledge network that would allow for dialogue between the people who have information and people who need it.
In the past, one of the ways in which these things have tended to be done is that the research community comes up with information that they think is useful, and then they just make it available. They put out a report or we put out publications, and then it's the user's problem to figure out whether any of that information is useful or not. And it more often than not, it comes across in ways that are not as useful as it could be. And so if there's a dialogue that could be established that would allow users to say, okay, here's our problem. This is the information we need to solve our problem. And then if the research community can tailor their research results to relate to those problems, it's much more likely that it'll be effective.
Were there any things that you found in the work that you were doing in the areas that you were focused on, the natural sciences, that were very surprising or particularly alarming or different than what you'd expected?
Well, some of the things that I found surprising were things that scientists have been talking about for a long time, but it didn't come home to me personally. For example, 40 years from now, in 2050, the projected temperatures for Fairbanks are similar to what they are in Saskatoon. So here we are in a boreal climate with a boreal forest, and in a very short period of time, we're going to be likely to be facing temperatures that are typical of a prairie. And what does a forest do when it's living in a prairie climate? That sort of brings home to me the magnitude of changes that are likely to occur.
And so what happens now? You've come up with this body of work. How optimistic are you that these will be implemented and carried forward?
I'm optimistic that this information will be really useful. For one thing, it was an incredibly good group of people that the state of Alaska brought together to talk about these things. So I think it resulted in a much more focused understanding for all of those people that were involved in the process of developing these recommendations of what really needs to be done. So there's a much more of a consensus of what needs to be done. And so I think people are individually going to work towards making those things happen, regardless of how it plays out in terms of implementation by the state of Alaska. What I don't know at this point is to what extent the state is going to take an active role in planning for adapting to the future. I guess my concern is that climate change has become a political issue rather than a scientific issue.
It seems that there's a sense of urgency about addressing some of the changes that are taking place. And yet we can't get climate change legislation advancing, and things sort of languish when it comes to these discussions, as you said, because it becomes political. What can happen, or what needs to happen from your perspective as a scientist to get this thing going forward? And if it doesn't, what do you think we're facing in 10 years?
Well, one thing that I think that I've learned is that I think it's really important to think about the opportunities that we face in a changing climate rather than to focus on the bad things that are going to happen. Because when you talk about the bad things, everybody tends to want to withdraw from those issues and bury their heads in the sand. But there's tremendous opportunities to make the choices about what we want to do in the future. And so I think the scientific community can do a much better job of presenting information in such a way that it's clear what choices we have available to us. Another thing that's come out of become apparent to me in looking at the climate change efforts is that the most effective progress has been made at the local level, and communities have really taken action and done things. And only when communities have stepped up, then the states begin to take action.
Terry Chapin is an ecologist at UAF's Institute of Arctic Biology. The interior's warm fall continues as high pressure that's dominated Alaska weather for the past 2 weeks persists. National Weather Service meteorologist Rick Toman says it's resulted in consistently above normal temperatures and a few records.
Temperatures in Fairbanks have been averaging about 7 to 10 degrees above normal for the last 10 days or so. No records here, but not far to the west, records have been set. McGrath set or tied a record every day between Sunday and Friday, and record highs on Sunday at both Nome and Kotzebue.
The Nome and Kotzebue records were 60 degrees, while the McGrath highs were all around 70. Toman says the high-pressure system has substantially delayed the first official freeze at the Weather Service's Fairbanks recording station.
The average date at Fairbanks International Airport over the last 55 years is September 7th, and it has still not been down to 32 at the airport.
Toman says many areas have seen frost over the last month, and those that haven't likely will in the next several days as the high-pressure air lifts.
That feature actually is still going to be there, but it's going to move westward into Russia, and we're going to get some colder air in from the east and northeast.
Toman says while temperatures will cool somewhat, it's expected to remain dry. The average first snow in Fairbanks is September 23rd, but Toman says there's no precipitation in the current outlook.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. If you smoke, odds are you want to quit. And if you want to quit, you're probably finding it tough to do. The Alaska Tobacco Quit Line can help. The average smoker tries 10 times before they quit for good. You can increase your chances by calling the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line. A trained quit coach is waiting for your call. Give it a shot. It's free and it works. Call the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line at 1-800-QUIT-NOW. This message sponsored by the Alaska Tobacco Quit Line.
Nathan Berkowitz wants to make cuts to a very small portion of the state's revenue in exchange for a large return to Alaskan businesses. The Democrats' candidate for governor says that reductions to the corporate income tax, less than 1% of the state's total income, would be balanced by an increase in the number of businesses headquartered in the state and be an economic stimulus. In announcing his plan, Berkowitz said the goal is to make the state less dependent on resource extraction while getting more benefits from the resources themselves.
We're trying to generate economic development in Alaska and create new jobs and new opportunities for Alaskans. And we're doing that by reducing the tax burden on small businesses and creating incentives for larger businesses to create jobs in the state and create renewable energy opportunities to move research and development to Alaska. If we do all that, then we can help diversify the economy.
Berkowitz wants to eliminate all taxes for companies making less than $90,000 a year and reduce the tax rate on larger businesses from 9.4% to 4.9%. He would also offer tax credits in 7 separate categories. He says those incentives include such breaks as credits for companies that are headquartered in the state, that have 100 or more employees, that do research and development in Alaska, or that bank in the state.
You get credit for each thing that you do. And if you're bringing a big research and development firm to Alaska and you hire 100 Alaskans, you'd get 2 sets of credits. And it would be cumulative in that sense.
The corporate income tax is separate from oil, gas, and mining taxes and is projected to bring in $80 million in the current year. Berkowitz says that is $20 million less than last year. His reductions and incentives are estimated to cost the state $38 million based on the current tax regime. Governor Sean Parnell did not directly address Berkowitz's proposal, but his campaign staff issued a statement criticizing Berkowitz's opposition to federal tax cuts and his opposition to tax cuts for the oil industry. Several Alaska Native leaders are backing Lisa Murkowski's write-in campaign bid to hold onto her U.S. Senate seat. The Legislative Committee of the Alaska Federation of Natives voted yesterday to endorse Murkowski. And Willie Hensley, author and former state senator, joined the crowd Friday when Murkowski launched her campaign.
I'm here with a lot of supporters of hers, and of course I think it's a historic occasion, and I like Lisa Murkowski, so I'm here to hear what she has to say. No, I think she has a wonderful chance. I mean, it's a gigantic challenge, but I love Alaskan politics because, you know, nothing is set in stone, you know, anything can happen.
Later, State Senator Albert Kukesh, who is a Democrat who also co-chairs the Alaska Federation of Natives, spoke in Murkowski's favor.
Almost to a person in a recent board meeting asked Lisa Murkowski to run. They begged Lisa Murkowski to run. The Alaska Native community will be there for her. We owe her so much. And we're going to be there to do our share to try to get her elected. No, I'm not going to be here just to waste my time and to have fun. I want to come here to win. There's a lot of times in the state where the Native community and the non-Native community have a line and a division between them. This can't be one of those times.
Senator Kukesh is the chairman of Sea Alaska Corporation. Murkowski supports a bill that would allow Sea Alaska Corporation to select lands within the Tongass National Forest. The life cycle of coho salmon may be more complicated than once thought. Researchers are finding that some fish may grow up in more than one stream. Malati Kay has the story.
Look at that.
State biologist Leon Schall and Forest Service hydrologist Emil Tucker are leading a field trip at a stream alongside Omer Creek Trail. Peering into a bucket of swimming sculpin and coho fry, the pair explain how these fish make up the stream's food web.
At least a dozen sculpins.
What's a sculpin? A bottom feeder?
Yes, they are.
Yeah.
And they eat
and
a lot of
you eat them?
Nobody does. They don't get very large, but they eat a lot of salmon.
Shaw studies southeast coho populations for the Department of Fish and Game. He points out that the species spends two-thirds of its life in freshwater, so streams such as Omer Creek play a major role in the continuing strength of southeast Alaskan coho runs and commercial coho catch.
Our catch in recent years has been quite large relative to the Pacific Rim. Last 10 years, it's been about half of the worldwide catch of coho salmon, and that's up substantially from 30 years ago. It was only around 10%.
Coho are thought to spend the first 1.5 to 3.5 years of their life in freshwater before spending a year in saltwater and returning to their natal streams to spawn. In recent years, Shaw thinks he may have found evidence suggesting that the coho life cycle is a little more complex. Studying the otoliths, or inner years of juvenile coho in streams around Juneau, Shaw found that some of the young fish were not born in the stream he had caught them in. Rather, they were from a stream 40 miles away.
And that really expands the concept of habitat beyond just the stream into the estuary, into marine waters and into distant streams, some of which don't have enough habitat to support a coho, an entire population.
Shaw says the first instance of the straying coho was found by retired Fish and Game biologist Brian Lynch on the Stikeen River. It was a hatchery fish that had been released into Omer Creek as a smolt. Since then, Shaw has found a handful of similar instances with wild coho straying along the upper Lynn Canal. Shaw thinks this might be a sign of a larger trend that scientists have not paid attention to. So far, the evidence is anecdotal with only 8 individual fish.
We've seen a few over the years, but it's kind of looking for a needle in a haystack to find a small tagged fish that's moved from one river to another. It's not something you'd commonly find just by odds.
The theory of a trend makes sense to Forest Service's Emil Tucker.
Like, as an evolutionary tactic, I think all salmon stray to some degree because it helps them to exploit habitat. Like right now in Glacier Bay, there's streams just sort of popping out of the landscape as the glaciers are receding. And so these are new streams. And within a few years, people have noticed that they get colonized by fish. So where do the fish come from? They come probably, you know, most likely they come from the next salmon stream down the road. But as Leon is showing with his research, they could come from, you know, some big stream that has an oversupply of salmon.
Tucker is not sure Shaw's findings will affect regional forest management practices.
In this day and age, we've pretty much said that anything that has fish in it is off limits. We put a buffer on it.
Fishery management practices have already accounted for the findings' possible implications, according to Shaw.
You know, we're looking at indicators for a general management area, and we're not focused on each small stream generally.
Shaw also found that the health of a stream's coho population was linked to the stream's pink salmon population.
Because our streams are we're in a high rainfall area, and basically a lot of our streams just run off of granite into saltwater. Nutrients brought in by salmon carcasses, and particularly pink salmon carcasses, are very important in food web in streams. And coho salmon, being a rearing species that spend a considerable amount of time living and growing in streams, particularly benefit from that.
Shaw was one of several scientists that presented at the Tongass Rainforest Festival in Petersburg over the weekend of September 10th. In Petersburg, I'm Melody Kay.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at aprn.org. You can follow us on Twitter at aprn. We had reports tonight from Matt Miller in Juneau, Ellen Lockyer in Anchorage, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, and Melody Kay in Petersburg. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., and Dave Donaldson from Juneau. Our editor and producer is Annie Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. And I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A.
Providing statewide news coverage since 1978, we are the Alaska Public Radio Network, APRN, your source for Alaska's news.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.